a.m. on Wednesday, September 1st. Before we begin, I want to thank Lori Rowland, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings. Nate Williams and Vanessa Head from the Juneau and Anchorage LIOs make sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room, and actually committee members, I think everybody on the phone, but please silence your cell phones so we don't have much ringing going on at the same time. Present today, I'll call your name and you can confirm that you're here with Representative Kirka.
Here.
Representative Eastman. Representative Vance.
I'm here.
Representative Price Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Drummond.
I'm on the phone.
My vice chair, Representative Snyder.
I'm here.
And myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Joint Resolution 7, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund and Permanent Fund Dividends, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the sixth hearing of the joint resolution in the House Judiciary Committee. Today we will hear more invited testimony. Proposed constitutional amendments addressing financial issues raise questions about funds that are subject to the sweep provisions in Article 9, Section 17. The leading case applying those provisions is Hickel versus Cooper, a 1994 case. Most recently, the Superior Court in Alaska Federation of Natives versus Dunleavy ruled that the Power Cost Equalization Fund was not in the general fund and was not sweepable under Article 9, Section 17. These two cases lead to a number of questions, and so today, because I believe these actually bear on our consideration of the resolution that's been proposed, I've invited both a person from the Department of Law as well as an attorney from Legislative Legal Services to answer a number of questions. Prior to the meeting, I distributed questions to the presenters and to the committee. We're going to start with hearing from Corey Mills from the Department of Law. Then we'll hear from Megan Wallace from Legislative Legal. I just want to note, because I know Ms. Wallace actually has child care duties or pickup duties starting right around 2 o'clock. My plan will be to hear from Ms. Mills for about 30 minutes. Then we'll have Ms. Wallace for about 30 minutes. And then if there's follow-up questions for Ms. Mills, we'll return to her after Ms. Wallace probably has to leave our hearing to go take care of getting her children. So, Ms. Mills, if you want to identify yourself on the record, and you can begin your remarks. I would note that committee members should have the list of questions. Of course, we can ask any questions we want, but I would suggest if you want to go through the questions provided, you can answer those questions, and then we'll start taking follow-up questions from members of the committee.
Yes, Chair Clayman. So this is Corey Mills, for the record, Deputy Attorney General at the Department of Law. Thanks for having me before the committee today. I hope you can hear me okay.
Coming in loud and clear.
Great. So I, as you suggested, I will walk through the questions that you provided, Chair Clayman, and then, of course, if there are other questions, I'm happy to answer those. So starting with number one, are there cases other than Hickel versus Cooper and AFN versus Dunleavy, which is the PCE case formerly mentioned, that address whether particular funds are subject to the sweep? Not to my knowledge. Hickel versus Cooper is the one Supreme Court case to interpret available for appropriation. That was actually more in regards to subsection B of the constitutional amendment. Not the sweep, but the court did say available for appropriation should be interpreted the same for both of those provisions. It did not address what is in the general fund for purposes of the sweep. And that's AFN versus Dunleavy, the Superior Court case. The state has chosen not to appeal that case, and so it is binding as to the PCE, but otherwise not binding on other courts. Number two, has Judge Garten's decision in AFN versus Dunleavy changed how the Department of Law analyzes whether or not a fund is sweepable and how. I think our approach to this Superior Court decision is to look at the PCE and the facts surrounding the PCE, and are there other similarly situated funds that we otherwise considered sweepable, but now should not be considered sweepable because they are so similar to the PCE. In looking at that, the PCE is very unique. It is the only fund that was on the sweep list that exists within a public corporation but was otherwise available for appropriation. And because PCE is so unique, we didn't find any other funds that really fit that exact fact pattern. Otherwise, the department still interprets the HICL decision is really the binding precedent so far, as it is a Supreme Court case on issues regarding the sweep. So the administration, we're on number three. The administration did not appeal AFN versus Dunleavy. What is the precedent of the Superior Court decision, and how will it affect Alaska courts considering whether funds are subject to the sweep? And is the court's decision on page 12, footnotes 76 and 77, binding on future courts? So stepping back, and I kind of addressed this in number two, but AFN versus Dunleavy was a Superior Court case, so it is not binding. The opinion will not be published. So the only, legally, its only impact is relating to the PCE. The court ordered that the PCE not be swept, and the administration is not sweeping PCE in accordance with that legal mandate by the Superior Court. Anything else in that decision is persuasive only. If another court case were to be brought, another court does not have to follow the Superior Court reasoning or decision, and the Alaska Supreme Court, of course, is in no way bound by a Superior Court decision. In regards to the dicta in footnotes 76 and 77, for those of you who may not be as familiar with the opinion, on page 12, the court cites basically saying there are other funds that the legislature has determined are separate funds, and then it just cites a bunch of statutes that refer to the term separate fund. So those are simply dicta, they're simply footnotes, and it appears the court was just trying to show the range in which the legislature has acted in regards to funds. Because there is no fund that is precisely similar to PCE, the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund, there are no other funds like that that exist in public corps. You know, this is a list of other funds that use the term separate fund. But the court did not independently analyze each of these. There's no evidence that the court went through and looked at the legislative history, that the court was interpreting those statutes as to whether the funds were, in the general fund or not. It was simply citations to footnotes for purposes of illustrating different ways in which the legislature has explained funds within the law. So in that regard, without any analysis by the court, without any legal mandate, there's nothing binding about those footnotes in any way. Again, we continue to go back to HICL versus Cooper as our main case, interpreting the sweep provision. So please explain the difference, number four, if any, between the general fund and the state treasury. And all I can say here is I think it depends on who you ask.
We're asking you, so.
Yeah, there are a lot of statutes that use different terms, and they don't seem to be used consistently. There's fund, there's account, there's general fund, there's treasury. You know, it's not clear that the legislature, when they enacted all those statutes, had different meanings in mind. Each statute, I think you'd have to go back and look at the legislative history. What was the legislature intending when it, you know, used those terms? Because in some places, treasury and general fund seem to be used in the same way. In other circumstances, it appears that the Treasury could be viewed as a, you know, the larger state treasury under the Constitution, and then you have funds, and the general fund is one of those. So it depends on the context as to what is meant by those terms. And then you have general fund, of course, in the CBR statute, the Constitutional Budget Reserve statute. What did the voters intend when they voted for that amendment for general fund to mean? So I don't mean to be flippant, but it is, these are not clearly defined terms. There's no statute defining these terms, and they're not used consistently within the statutes themselves. And so there's not one way to define each of them and to say these are the differences and are they the same. So I think it depends on the context and having to go back and look at the legislative history on each of the statutes. So number five, please advise whether the following funds are subject to sweep and why or why not. So there's a number of funds here. I just want to step back really quickly and mention that aside from the PCE, and again, any funds that you can categorize as PCE, and we couldn't find any, the sweep analysis hasn't changed. So the list that the Office of Management and Budget has continues to remain the same in terms of what's subject to the sweep and what's not. So the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve Account, this account was specifically pointed out in Hickel versus Cooper and said it was not subject to the sweep because it existed in the permanent fund and not in the general fund by statute. Funds such as the School Construction Grant Fund, so I'll start by saying that fund has never been subject to the sweep because it can be spent without an appropriation, and therefore it doesn't meet the second part of the test. It both has to be in the general fund, and it has to be available for appropriation, which is the whole Hickel versus Cooper analysis. This fund can be spent without appropriation, which Hickel versus Cooper found means that it's not available and therefore not subject to the sweep. So this fund is not subject to the sweep, hasn't been. And as for expressly created in the general fund, so, you know, that's clear then that it's in the general fund, but it was already not on the sweep list for another reason. The next one, funds such as the Curriculum Improvement and Best Practices Fund. This fund doesn't mention where it's at. It just establishes the fund. We don't read any meaning into that. It has to go somewhere. And so the fact that it doesn't say general fund doesn't really change our analysis. But again, this particular fund apparently has never had any money in it, so it hasn't been swept. And in addition, I believe it can be spent without appropriation, again, so it wouldn't be on the sweep list to begin with. In-state natural gas pipeline fund, established in a state corporation. All the other funds aside from the PCE that are in state corporations, to my knowledge, can be spent without appropriation. So because they can be spent without appropriation, they aren't available for appropriation under the Hickel versus Cooper analysis, and therefore it is not on the sweep list. But it otherwise would be similar to PCE in that it exists in a state corporation and therefore wouldn't be swept for the second reason as well. Disaster relief funds, same thing with this one. It can be spent without appropriation. And as for, you know, it's established in the office of the governor, since we know it can be spent without appropriation, and so it's not going to be swept anyway, we really haven't done any further analysis beyond that. Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund. Again, this was the subject of the AFN decision. The PCE is not subject to the sweep following that decision, and the administration has ensured that that money is available. The Statutory Budget Reserve Fund. This fund has always been viewed by both the legislature and the executive branch as available for appropriation and in the general fund and subject to the sweep, and it remains on the sweep list. The Service Members Group Life Insurance Premium Fund, this is another fund that can be spent without appropriation. So we haven't really done a separate analysis because it doesn't meet one prong of the test already and therefore is not sweepable. So HB 3003, recently approved by the House, appropriates dividend funds from the statutory budget reserve to pay the permanent fund dividend. What is the administration's current position with respect to an appropriation from the statutory budget reserve? And as I stated before, the SBR has historically been found to be sweepable. We don't think that the ASN decision in any way binds the state to a new interpretation. It also isn't a, you know, similarly situated fund. It's not in a corporation. It says it's in the state treasury. As I stated before, exactly what that means and in what context, we'd have to go back and look at the legislative history, but it's also evident that both sides have always considered it sweepable, which we think points to the fact that everyone believed it was in the general fund. So that means that funds that are in, that were in the SBR, the Statutory Budget Reserve Fund, as of June 30th, you know, at midnight, that were not previously validly committed, were swept. So you basically have no money in that fund from which to do any new additional appropriations. When does that happen? It happens by operation of law at 11:59 p.m. on June 30th of any given fiscal year. And then the way the reverse sweep happens is basically a minute later, those funds are taken. So at 11:59, they're swept into the CBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve, and at, you know, midnight or 12:01, they're swept back out when you have a reverse sweep that has been passed. And I think the last question, if the governor contends the SBR funds are subject to sweep, and the legislature contends they are not, what options are available to the legislature to resolve any disputes? I think legislation could be passed clarifying where the statutory budget reserve is. You know, if you make it more similar to power cost equalization endowment fund and more similar to the ASN decision, that could bring some clarity. And otherwise, it's, you know, further discussion between the two branches on what the terms in the Constitution mean. I don't know if there's anything else you'd like me to add to that.
At this point, I don't, but I'm happy to, at this point, happy to take questions from members of the committee. I know since we're all on the phone, I would say if you want to, if you have a question, just let me know. I'll put you in the queue, and you can have questions. I'd also note that Neil Steininger is present on the phone and can also answer questions if folks have questions for Mr. Steininger. Actually, one question I'll ask before I hear other questions. You referenced the list. Does the Department of Law or OMB have a list of all funds, both ones that are sweepable and ones not sweepable, that kind of list that give us the landscape of these sweepable and not sweepable funds that they can provide to the committee?
Chair Clayman, Corey Mills again for the record. I would refer to Neil Steininger. I believe that list is either held by the Office of Management and Budget or Division of Finance. Legislative Audit has also had a list prepared.
Okay.
Yes, for the record, Neil Steininger, Office of Management and Budget. Chair Clayman, yes, that's a list that we can provide, as Ms. Mills stated. Division of Finance maintains a list for their production of the annual financial reports, and that can be provided to the committee.
That'd be great. Members of the committee, anybody questions for either? We'll start with Ms. Mills. And questions for Ms. Mills?
Chair Clayman. This is Rep. Vance. I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Vance.
Ms. Mills, does the administration have a position on whether or not the PCE fund should continue to be in the constitutional amendment proposal? In light of the recent court case.
Representative Vance, through the chair, that's not something I can speak to. I have not heard that there are plans to change that proposal at this point, but I'd be happy to have someone get back to the committee who's leading that bill.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have, would you be able to speak to any legal effects of in the future, in light of the court case, if the PCE was not included in the constitutional provision as proposed in HJR 7?
So, through the chair, Representative Vance, I think all I can say about in terms of the legal status of the fund is, you know, even though the fund is not sweepable at the moment, it is fully available for appropriation, and therefore can be used for, you know, multiple purposes by the legislature or even all the money used. So, you know, placing the money that's in the endowment fund into the permanent fund and creating some sort of constitutional protection would make it so that you couldn't do that. You know, you couldn't ever take the whole fund or appropriate the whole fund in any way. So that's the one, I guess, legal status difference that I'd point out.
One more follow-up.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the proposal is written regarding the PCE and utilizing the percent of market value draw for power cost equalization in the state, if the legislature wanted to use that portion of the funds to invest in energy infrastructure in rural Alaska, would it be permissible under the current language, or is it exclusively for the PCE subsidy program?
So, Representative Vance, through the chair, again, I'm going to have to apologize. I am not lead on the constitutional amendment, and I would need to look at that language and consult with the lead attorney on it, but I'm happy to get back to you on that question.
Thank you.
I'll follow up briefly for Representative Vance. What about under the current structure, if the legislature wanted to use funds in the PCE endowment under the structure today, could we use that to purchase electric or build an electric infrastructure in rural Alaska, or is there something that would prohibit that?
Chair Clayman, there's nothing that would prohibit using money from the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund to pay for that project.
I know I jumped in a little bit, Representative Vance. Any further follow-up?
No, thank you. That's helpful.
Other members of the committee with questions for Ms. Mills?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. This is Representative Perka.
Representative Perka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for coming before us, Ms. Mills. I was listening to your testimony a minute ago, and you were going back and forth with describing different funds that were subject to the sweep and ones that were not. And you talked about, of course, the question of whether something's in the general fund or not, which I'm having a problem understanding, I guess, how we can have so many funds that are not in the general fund and not represent the Constitution. But aside from that issue, the question of available for appropriation and versus, you mentioned several funds that where stuff is paid out that it's not, things are paid for out of those funds that they're not appropriated. And I'm having a little bit of, I guess, trouble understanding how that works, because I'm looking at our state constitution. In Article 9, Section 13, it expressly says that no money shall be withdrawn from the treasury except in accordance with appropriation made by law. And then it says no obligation for the payment of money shall be incurred except for, as authorized by law. So I could see having, I guess, laws in the books, I'm sure we do, that outline payment for programs or various expenses, but the money still can't be taken out unless it's appropriated. So I'm having difficulty understanding how we as a state are, or the administration is paying for things that have not been appropriated.
So through the chair, Representative Kirka, that's an excellent question and one that I think has confused a lot of people over the years. The issue is there's kind of two types of appropriations that the legislature normally does in the budget bill. There's appropriations into funds that then need to be further appropriated, like the Power Cost Equalization Fund, and then there's an appropriation into a fund that has automatic spending authority. So the appropriation authority occurred, and it goes into the fund. For example, the permanent fund dividend is a prime example of this. Once you put the money in the permanent fund dividend fund, then there's a calculation that the Department of Revenue does, and they send out the check. You don't need a further appropriation from the fund, because once it's in the fund, there's a way to spend it, and the statute tells them how to spend it. So that's all I mean by to spend without further appropriation. The money was already appropriated once, and this particular fund, the funds I listed, can be spent, the money can then be spent automatically by the agency per a statute. There are other funds where you appropriate in, but there's another appropriation that's necessary before the money can actually be expended from the Treasury.
Follow, Mr. Chairman?
Thank you.
So if I understand correctly, you're saying that you can, it sounds like you're saying there can be multi-year appropriations that are, so the legislature would say authorize something as an appropriation at one point in time, and it would stay as an authorization for appropriations in perpetuity. Forever, basically, instead of being on an annual basis.
Sorry, through the chair, Representative Kirka. So the annual basis has to do with the legislature having control of the funds that come in within its purview that year and being able to spend those. That money could still be expended for years in the future. Good examples of this are the public corporation funds. You've got the ADA revolving loan fund. You've got the AGDC in-state and Alaska Gas Line. I think it has two funds. And they've been pulling out of those funds for, you know, the last 10 years or more. Sometimes new appropriations are put in, but the whole point is that the money is still available. But the legislature that year has control over where they want the money to go. And that meets the annual requirement, if that makes sense. But the money could still be expended for future years through, like you said, a multi-year appropriation, but you can only spend the money that's in front of you that year. You can't try to spend another legislature's money, or at least that's the position of the Department of Law that is currently being litigated in the forward appropriation case.
Follow, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kirkham.
So you mentioned, Ms. Mills, you mentioned in your testimony, I guess, a distinction between available for appropriation, and you didn't use these words, but it sounded like you were suggesting that the distinction between funds that are available for appropriation and where money is not only for available for appropriation, and versus, say, funds that are only available for appropriation, and as one of the tests, and I guess it didn't make a lot of sense to me, because if something's available for appropriation doesn't mean it's, I wouldn't necessarily think that would mean it's an exclusive statement that it can only be available for appropriation. Is that your interpretation, or is that the court's interpretation of this constitutional provision with the suite, that it only applies to funds that are only available for appropriation?
So So through the chair, Representative Kirka, this all goes back to Hickel versus Cooper, and there the court enunciated a test for determining what is considered, quote, available for appropriation, end quote, under the Constitutional Budget Reserve provision, both for purposes of subsection B, which determines when you need a majority vote versus a three-quarters vote, and for purposes of the sweep, where the same language is used. The court describes the available for appropriation as follows. Instead, we consider it appropriate as well as consistent with both the language of the amendment and the intent of the framers to focus on the legal status of the various funds implicated in relationship to the legislative power of appropriation. The amount available for appropriation must include all funds over which the legislature has retained the power to appropriate. So that's when I talk about, can you spend without further appropriation, or is another appropriation needed? If another appropriation is needed, the legislature has retained the power to appropriate over those funds, and which are not available to pay expenditures without further legislative appropriation. So that's when we're talking about what's available for appropriation for purposes of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That's the test the court has lined out. Retained the power to appropriate. Has the legislature retained the power to appropriate? And making such that the funds are available to pay expenditures by the legislature. So I hope that helps.
So let me ask one follow-up question on Representative Kirk's question, and then I actually want to turn and give Ms. Wallace an opportunity to present her testimony, and then Ms. Mills, if you can stand by, because I know when we lose Ms. Wallace, I think there's plenty of questions we're going to still have for you. But I want to specifically look at the Power Cost Equalization Fund, because the court, as I understand it, ruled that that endowment is not in the general fund, which was the basis of Judge Garten's ruling. Hence, it wasn't subject to sweep because it wasn't in the general fund, but it's still available for appropriation. So even though the legislature has put that money into the Power Cost Equalization Endowment, and there's provisions that allow for expenditure of those funds, the legislature could appropriate that money in a variety of different ways, but it still isn't subject to sweep. Have I got that right?
So, Chair Klayman, I believe so. Just to reiterate, there's a two-part test for the sweep. So Hickel versus Cooper only dealt with the term available for appropriation. In subsection B of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Amendment, it doesn't refer to the general fund. It just says, you know, you're comparing what's available for appropriation to what was actually, spent or budgeted the previous year. In subsection D is where the term in the general fund is introduced. And so there's a two-part test to determine if monies are sweepable. The first part of the test is it in the general fund? The second part of the test is it available for appropriation? As you point out, the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund was found by the Hickel versus Cooper Court to be available for appropriation. The question that the court grappled with is, in the majority of its opinion, is it in the general fund since it is designated as in the Alaska Energy Authority? And the court determined that because it was in the Alaska Energy Authority, therefore it was not in the general fund, but rather in the corporation.
All right. What we'll go ahead and do, and Ms. Mills, I am sure Representative Kirka probably has some more questions for you, but I want to try to be respectful of Ms. Wallace's time constraints that started about 2. Ms. Wallace, if you want to go ahead and present your testimony, identify yourself for the record, you can work through the list of questions that we've previously provided, and then we'll open up for questions. And Ms. Wallace, when is the time at which you really have to get off the phone? Ms. Wallace, are you with us? Ms. Wallace, can you hear us?
There
There we go. I think I was muted. Hi. Good afternoon. This is Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Good afternoon. I have to jump off the phone here in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock, but once I disconnect from my office, I'll connect back on my cell phone and hopefully be available again maybe after the committee goes through and asks some follow-up questions to Ms. Mills. So once you see me reconnected, if there's additional questions, I'll do my best to be available a little later.
Okay.
So going through, just to kind of begin where Ms. Mills left off and going through the list, I don't think it's efficient to go through each of the questions, particularly because I think Ms. Mills and I don't disagree on a large part of what she described to the committee. And so in looking at the questions that the committee presented in terms of whether there's any additional cases or whether or not the AFN case is considered precedent or binding on future courts, I don't have anything additional to add to those topics that Ms. Mills didn't already cover for the committee. And if there are any follow-up questions later, I'm happy to take that. So if it's okay with the committee, I'll start on number four, which is explain the difference, if any, between the general fund and the state treasury. And as Ms. Mills noted, you know, that is a complicated question, and even the court in the AFN v. Dunleavy case noted that that is what presents, you know, a more difficult question. But the AFN versus Dunleavy case that was recently litigated in Superior Court, the majority of the opinion offered in that case is precisely what was litigated and what was before the court to decide. And while the committee can confirm with Ms. Mills, the Department of Law in that litigation took a very firm litigation position that when analyzing what is in the general fund versus the state treasury, in the litigation, the Department of Law took the position that all funds except for constitutional funds, being the permanent fund and the CBR, are all funds except for those two constitutional funds are in the general fund. In other words, there's a few constitutional funds, being the permanent fund and the constitutional budget reserve fund, and everything else is in the general fund. And that was the position that the Department of Law argued in the AFN case, and the plaintiffs argued that there was a broader definition of what is the Treasury, and that the legislature had the power to establish separate funds outside of the general fund but would still be considered within the state's Treasury, and therefore still be bound by the constitutional requirement that, you know, money appropriated from the state or money could not be expended from the state treasury, you know, absent appropriation. And so the court in the AFN v. Dunleavy case looked through the legislative history of the CBR amendment, and it found that that the legislative history did not indicate that the amendment itself, and the amendment being the Constitutional Budget Reserve Amendment, did not constrain the legislature's authority to establish a fund outside the general fund. And specifically, in that case, found that the legislature was not prohibited from establishing funds outside the general fund, for example, by the Dedicated Funds Clause. So the opinion in AFN v. Dunleavy, while it has not been appealed. So as Ms. Mills indicated, to which I concur, the opinion is an unpublished Superior Court opinion, and so at most it will have persuasive value if a separate court were to consider similar issues in terms of determining specifically which funds are in the general fund versus in the state treasury, which would have an impact on potential future analysis as to what funds can be swept. And while Hickel v. Cooper is a Alaska Supreme Court which does analyze Article 9, Section 17, the case did not specifically do any analysis on this issue of determining which funds were in the general fund and versus the legislature's power to set up a fund separate from the general fund but still within the state treasury. And the distinction there would be, as I concur with Ms. Mills, the analysis when you're determining whether or not something is available for sweep or whether it's subject to the sweep, I should say, is whether is a two-part test of is it available for appropriation and is it in the general fund. And as we sit here today, the only case that specifically analyzes that second issue about whether or not something is in the general fund is the recent AFN versus Dunleavy case. And so it the impact from my position in terms of the advice that I give to the legislature is that while it's only a Superior Court decision, it's not binding on future courts, it should the issue arise, but it should be instructive in terms of at least evaluating how future courts might come out on the issue. Certainly a court, it's always possible that a court could reach a different conclusion, but it's also could be persuasive to future courts in analyzing these issues. And to the extent that there is new interpretation about what it means to be in the general fund versus in the state treasury, funds that had not previously been subject to that analysis, we may have to kind of go back and analyze them in terms of whether or not if those funds were then looked at, whether a court would reach a conclusion different than what has been the historical interpretation. And the example of that is the statutory budget reserve fund. When Hickel v. Cooper was litigated back in the 90s, the parties agreed or stipulated that the statutory budget reserve fund was available for appropriation. And that was the main issue that was being litigated in Hickel v. Cooper. And so there was no real dispute that the fund was available for appropriation. But I'm not aware of any specific analysis that has occurred really examining that fund and analyzing whether or not it's in the general fund or whether the legislature exercised its lawmaking power and established that fund as a special fund separate from the general fund.
You want to go through and review some of the funds that were discussed in question five in terms of how you proceed or where do you want to go next?
Sure. You know, I didn't necessarily unfortunately didn't have the time to go through each of these funds specifically and do that, you know. This is emerging case law in terms of the definition of in general fund. And so some of these funds, my office hasn't had the time to sit down and look at the legislative history and do a full analysis. But I think that the testimony from Ms. Mills and myself, I think that it we're both consistent in an understanding that what the test is, and when we are analyzing these funds, I agree that the test, you know, is it available for appropriation and is it in the general fund? And when we're looking at whether a fund is sweepable, as Ms. Mills was explaining, if a fund can be expended without further appropriation, meaning that the legislature has already appropriated money once into that fund, and by law, that money can be spent without having to enact a further appropriation, then those funds under Hickel v. Cooper are not sweepable. And the earnings reserve account, which is on the list, that fund was specifically addressed by Hickel v. Cooper, and the Alaska Supreme Court noted that even though that fund was available for appropriation, it was not in the general fund and therefore not subject to the sweep.
So, Ms. Wallace, I'm somewhat cognizant of your time constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you turn to question six about the discussion we started about the statutory budget reserve and what your perspective is on the question six about the statutory budget reserve in light of the AFN versus Dunleavy, and what's your perspective on whether that those funds are subject to sweep or not subject to sweep?
Certainly. So with respect to the statutory budget reserve fund, I believe, as previously mentioned and explained to the committee, in the AFN versus Dunleavy case, when the court was analyzing whether or not the PCE fund was in the general fund, the court specifically noted that the legislature has previously expressly created many funds in the general fund, and that the legislature, when it creates these funds in the general fund, is very specific and uses that language for that purpose, and that, on the other hand, the legislature has also created separate funds, as the court noted. And in footnote 77, which attaches to the sentence from the court that states that the legislature has also created separate funds, and then footnotes a list of funds that the legislature has specifically established but has not used that language that establishes them in the general fund. And so the list in footnote 77 evidences separate funds that the legislature has established, and one of the separate funds that the legislature has established is the statutory budget reserve fund, which is found in Alaska Statute 3705-540, subparagraph A, or paragraph A, and in the language that the court used in establishing the statutory budget reserve, or SBR, as sometimes is referred to, is that there is established as a separate fund in the state treasury, the budget reserve fund. And because the AFN versus Dunleavy case is the only case to analyze this issue of what funds are considered in the general fund, if it seems apparent from the language of the AFN case that the statutory budget reserve fund is a separate fund in the state treasury and separate from the general fund. And if it were to be litigated and a court were to find persuasive the analysis in the AFN case, there certainly could be an opinion or another opinion from a Superior Court or potentially from the Alaska Supreme Court holding that the statutory budget reserve fund is another fund that's outside the general fund and therefore not subject to the sweep. The position that was just described from the Department of Law it sounds like the administration has not reconsidered the sweepability of that fund in light of this decision, and therefore, to the extent that there's disagreement about what the AFN case really means with respect to the SBR, I guess I could potentially see a potential for litigation, particularly if there's a disagreement about how much money from the SBR is available to the legislature for appropriation going forward.
So we've got about 5 minutes before you have to get off the line. So I want to open it up to questions from members of the committee. Do members of the committee have questions for Ms. Wallace? And it sounds like maybe by 2:15 or 2:30 she may be back on the line for more follow-up. But questions for Ms. Wallace at this point? Members of the committee.
It's Representative Christ Tompkins, if I can get in queue.
Representative Christ Tompkins, please.
Thank you. Ms. Wallace, in terms of the AFN Deep Dunleavy case being an unpublished Superior Court decision, I'm not really familiar with the sort of how the formalities of legal precedent work. Was there or would there be any option to kind of force the question to get a more hard and concrete precedent on the record, so this kind of Alaska wouldn't be subjected to this kind of sort of uncertainty and just like stuff getting swept and broken and dysfunctional the way the last couple months have been in the future? How if an interested party like AFN or some other interested party wanted to try to force that, what recourse, if any, exists through the legal system to do so?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, unfortunately, the only mechanism for this issue to really be decided by the Alaska Supreme Court is for one of the parties involved in that litigation to appeal Judge Garten's decision to the Alaska Supreme Court, and that did not happen in this case. And so this decision from the Superior Court will not go to the Alaska Supreme Court. And our Supreme Court does not issue advisory opinions. So in some states, the legislature or somebody can certify questions to the Supreme Court asking them to kind of resolve, this issue or some dispute that exists. And our court system does not provide for that remedy to the legislature or any other branch of government. And so, unfortunately, if there is further dispute about the sweepability of the SBR or any other funds, that issue will have to be separately litigated. And if that issue were to be separately litigated, the court that takes up that issue the next time around the AFN case will not be considered binding precedent, meaning the court that takes up that issue will not be bound to follow the guidance, from the previous decision, and would be free to take, a fresh look and take a separate look at the issue. And there's risk that a court could reach a different conclusion because it's not binding precedent. But I can suspect or almost guarantee that if a similar issue were to get litigated, that, the Garten opinion would be cited and would be referenced, and somebody would likely argue that this is a second court should find, reach the same conclusion as Judge Garten, but the court will have the authority to reach whatever conclusion it deems appropriate.
Follow-up?
Representative Christ Tompkins.
So is it right, Ms. Wallace, to say that only the administration had the ability to take this up to the Supreme Court and create that sort of more binding, concrete precedent, and that was not available to AFN because AFN, the court sided with AFN's legal position?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, either party could appeal the decision by the court. I won't speak for the plaintiffs, but generally if a court issues an order in favor of one party, that's not the party that usually appeals a case because the decision favored them, but that's really a litigation decision made by the parties to the case. But in general, only the plaintiffs that represented the entities that represented the plaintiffs that filed the suit and the governor on behalf of the state of Alaska had the power to appeal that case.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. I'll give you one more question from a committee member for Ms. Wallace, and then we're going to let her go on with her after next afternoon. Anyone? Well, I don't hear anyone asking for a question, so Ms. Wallace, we'll go ahead and let you go with your 2 o'clock commitment, and we'll ask Ms. Mills to come back. I think there may be some further questions for Ms. Mills from members of the committee. I have some questions as well, but I'm happy to let the committee go first. Any members of the committee with further questions for Ms. Mills?
Representative Clayman, John Christensen.
Yeah, Representative Christ-Tompkins, please proceed.
Thank you. Ms. Phelps, forgive me if you previously sort of touched on this, but would it be possible to speak in more concrete terms why the administration didn't appeal to the Supreme Court, given the Superior Court disagreed with the administration's legal interpretation of the sweep?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, I mean, not appealing a decision has multiple, you know, there's multiple facets to that. You have to look at the time and resources. You have to look at the issue. In this case, the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund, as I mentioned before, is a pretty unique fund. So when you're, you know, looking at how broadly it applies, we felt like it's a fairly unique set of circumstances. And, you know, for those reasons and the feeling that the Superior Court, you know, told us to send out the funding and everyone was basically in agreement everyone wanted to get the payments out, and the time and resources and the uniqueness of the situation, it just wasn't one we felt like appealing.
Thank you.
I've got one question on the appeal question, and then see if others want to weigh in. As I understand Ms. Mills' testimony, if 10 years from now another administration wants to take a different perspective about the Power Cost Equalization Fund and whether it was sweepable or not sweepable, is it your perspective that specifically to the Power Cost Equalization Fund, the court's decision is binding on an administration 10 years from now?
Chair Clayman, unless there's intervening Supreme Court precedent that would reverse or overturn that decision, then it is an injunction on the state that lasts.
So it's not just binding on this administration, it would be binding on future administrations unless the Supreme Court issued an opinion that would give a basis to say that Darden's analysis is flawed.
Chair Clayman, yes, I believe that's correct.
Okay. Other members of the committee with questions for Ms. Mills?
Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Kirka.
Representative Kirka, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Mills. One of the questions I wrote down here during the first part of your talk, and then with our legal counsel, which he was talking about the authority to create funds outside the general fund. And I guess I was looking for, I guess when I read the Constitution, it seems clear to me there's intent to not have a bunch of funds that are not in the Constitution, that are not swept every year, to not have a bunch of dedicated funds. They're expressly prohibited. And it seems like we've been trying to play a game to get around that and to violate the intent of the Constitution. And I guess what I'm wondering is there a clear place where there's, and you said it was pretty confusing, but is there a clear place in the Constitution where it delineates the legislature's authority to create separate funds outside the general fund?
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, so I want to go back and address one item that I know Ms. Wallace touched on in terms of the state's position in the lawsuit. So I think you are in some ways enunciating what our position in the lawsuit was. And our position was the term general fund in the Constitution in Section 17, subsection D, when it refers to general funds, what the voters thought when they voted on that was that the general fund, they didn't think the general fund was different than, you know, the Alaska Energy Authority and the funds there or any other funds aside from, like you said, the constitutionally established funds. That was the state's position in the power cost equalization lawsuit. And the judge found that instead of saying that the term general fund, you know, had a specific meaning, what the judge basically said is that the legislature can determine what the general fund is and can determine which funds are the general fund versus which funds are not. That was not the state's position, but that's what the judge ultimately held. So in terms of is there a place in the Constitution that, you know, somehow allows the legislature to create separate funds, I don't think the Constitution ever contemplated that, especially as it originally stood before the Constitutional Budget Reserve. It, at that point, just talked about expenditures and the Treasury in general terms. But then you get the legislative authority in Article 2, which, of course, allows you to pass legislation, and you can pass legislation that ensures different pots of money go different places so that, you know, for accounting purposes, you know what's going on. But you still can't dedicate those funds. And that's Article 9, Section 8 of the Constitution, I think, that doesn't allow dedicated funds. And so you have funds, but they can't be dedicated to specific purposes. They can still be appropriated by the legislature, except for a few exceptions. So ultimately, sorry, the short answer is, no, the Constitution did not really contemplate that. It didn't think about it. It was more focused on the Treasury and making sure funds were expended pursuant to law passed by the legislature and signed into law by the governor.
And Representative Kirka, just as a side note, that in the Judge Garden's opinion, she notes on page 19 that the term general fund doesn't even appear in the Constitution until 1976, when it appears in Article 9, Section 15, establishing the permanent fund. So that adds more adventure to the analysis. Any follow-up, Representative Kirka?
Not at this time.
Other questions for Ms. Mills? Ms. Mills, I have a couple of questions. The first question, from a standpoint, I asked, there was earlier a question about what's in the Treasury, and is there a distinction between the Treasury and the general fund. What's your perspective about whether the permanent fund is part of the Treasury?
Chair Klayman, that is a really good question that I have to say, I don't think there's a clear answer to that. Is the Treasury all the money that the state receives? I don't think we have specific guidance on that. I think in the end, the Treasury would be viewed as the big Treasury, but there are arguments as well that the Treasury sits in one place and the permanent fund of the constitutional fund sits in another. again, going back to our arguments in the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund, our arguments there were focused on what is the general fund for purposes of the sweep in interpreting the constitutional budget reserve. And in that case, we definitely thought the voters didn't know about all these little funds. They thought the general fund is what the legislature can appropriate from, and so it's that universe of things that is in the general fund, except for your constitutionally created funds. So I know I didn't have an exact answer to your question, but I just don't think we have clarity on that, at least from a constitutional perspective, about how all that falls.
So even though there hasn't been a court decision or for that matter legislation articulating, there at least be one argument that could be made that the Treasury is everything, including the permanent fund, including the general fund, including the power cost equalization endowment. Basically, every dollar that is one or how or another owned by the state falls within the Treasury, and then there's a bunch of other things within the Treasury. There's a logical argument that could be made, but you're not sure where that is from a legal analysis standpoint.
Chair Klayman, yes, I would agree with that. And then you have a second question about when you're looking at statutes and the legislature uses the term Treasury or General Fund, what were they thinking of when they established that statute? Was it to mirror the Constitution, or was Treasury thought of in a different way? And that's where you come down to a statutory interpretation level that makes all of this a little convoluted and complex.
And if you don't know the answer, that totally wouldn't surprise me. I noted Judge Garden's opinion on page 19, where she notes that the general fund only appears in the Constitution for the first time in 1976. Are some of these statutes that we've talked about in which there's reference to the general fund, do any of those predate 1976? Or was the legislature referring to a general fund pre-1976, even before it showed up in the Constitution, or did the reference in the statutes only occur after 76, if you know?
Chair Klayman, that's an excellent question. I have had that question myself, but have not gone back and looked at exactly what the language is in particular funds and how the terminology was used before that time. So, unfortunately, I can't answer it, but it's a really good question.
All right. And then the last question I have, and then maybe we'll have then other members of the committee may have some follow-up. We were talking earlier about question 6B about the options if the governor and the legislature don't agree about whether the statutory budget reserve funds were subject to sweep for this year, effectively on June 30th of 2021. If the legislature went and passed a statute at some point in the future, whether tomorrow or next general session or whenever, in which we provided further clarity, would that have any impact on the sweepability question for the sweepability for right now? Or if we disagreed on it, would we have to effectively go to court and have the court decide whether it was sweepable or not?
Chair Klayman, I think it's accurate to say that it wouldn't affect things now, because you have to look at what the statute was when the sweep occurred, not what a new statute says, even if the legislature is saying it's clarifying, that still could be viewed as a substantive change. I don't want to say that litigation is the only way to resolve it, but as I think Ms. Wallace pointed out, and as we've noted in this hearing today, there's still a lot of questions about the interpretation of the constitutional budget reserve. We've now had two cases, one on available for appropriation at the Supreme Court level, one on what actually goes into the CBR, and then now we have one Superior Court case, but there are many surrounding questions that ultimately the Supreme Court would have to, weigh in on to get a definitive answer.
And this is a follow-up on that. Would you view the question about the statutory budget reserve more to do with whether it's in the general fund as opposed to whether it's available for appropriation?
Chair Klayman, absolutely. That's the fundamental question for the statutory budget reserve.
All Okay, so the availability for appropriation is really not a particularly challenging issue on that fund. It's more whether it's in the general fund or not.
Correct.
Okay. Those are the only things I had, but I would encourage other members of the committee follow-up questions or other questions for Ms. Mills.
And Chair Klayman, can I clarify one point, too?
Absolutely.
So Corey Mills again, for the record.
This is Ms. Mills again.
Yes. I just wanted to, someone, I think Representative Vance had asked about the governor's constitutional amendment and the power cost equalization and whether the position had changed on that, and I did get confirmation that the governor position has not changed. He would still like to see the power cost equalization endowment fund and the power cost equalization be constitutionalized so as to protect the endowment as well as ensure that a payment goes out every year. So I just wanted to give the administration's position on that since it was asked.
Representative Vance, any follow-up on that?
No, that provides clarification as we look at this bill and make a decision of our position as the legislature. Thank you for that, Ms. Mills.
All right, I'll see you again. Does any member of the committee want to have any further questions for Ms. Mills? I'm not hearing anyone. Does anyone on the committee have further questions for Ms. Wallace? She hasn't. I don't know if she's come back online, but does anyone on the committee have some additional questions for Ms. Wallace?
Chair Klayman?
Yes.
Hi. For the record, this is Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director, and I am back online. And if I could just take one quick moment to note that I wanted to just make sure that in terms of the options that are available to the legislature, even though, we are lawyers, we always hesitate to jump right to the recommendation to solve this issue by litigation because of the risks involved. But while litigation is always an option to kind of understand what the answer to this potential issue is, another option that is available to the legislature is to reverse the sweep and to reconstitute the statutory budget reserve fund so that those funds do remain available to the legislature to appropriate. So that is, reversing the sweep, finding additional funds to make up for any funds that were appropriated in HB 3003 are all additional options aside from litigation that the legislature has to pursue.
Ms. Wallace, I actually have a question on that. Hasn't the opportunity for the legislature to reverse the sweep, hasn't that now passed? Because if it was swept and we didn't reverse the sweep at the time of passing the budget, isn't it now in the constitutional budget reserve, and so we would need to essentially have a bill that takes the money from the constitutional budget reserve. It's the same three-quarter vote, but it really isn't a reverse the sweep anymore. Now, if we agree that it's in the statutory budget reserve, don't we essentially need a three-quarter vote to remove it from the statutory budget reserve and put it somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, the reverse sweep has always been simply an appropriation out of the constitutional budget reserve fund back to the funds which they originated. And so it would continue to be just an appropriation under Article 9, Section 17C from the CBR back to the original subfunds, meaning that any amount that had initially been swept from the SBR or any other account to the CBR, the legislature would just be enacting a separate appropriation that says we're going to take those same amounts and we're going to send them back to the original subfund. And that those appropriations would take, I presume that the legislature, if it made an appropriation or a reverse sweep from the CBR, would make those appropriations retroactive to July 1, which would allow any appropriations for the remaining fiscal year to be funded then out of those balances. A little bit of that appears to be a non-issue based on the administration's separate announcement of the manner or mechanism in which it's going to carry out the sweep this year, meaning that it's going to deem the FY22 appropriations not available for appropriation, so those funds will not be swept. But in terms of correcting or not, correcting is not the appropriate term, but in terms of sending any money that is swept by the administration from the SBR, if the administration sweeps the money from the SBR to the CBR, the legislature may withdraw that and appropriate it from the CBR back to the constitution or to the statutory budget reserve fund with a three-quarter vote. And once it does that, there will be money in that to fund future appropriations. So if they did that simultaneously and then used the funds for the dividends, that would be an option available for the legislature.
But that's different than the funds relating to the whammy funds, because the administration's position on the whammy funds were that because we made an appropriation of those funds before the end of the year, they were appropriated before the end of the fiscal year, and hence they were no longer available for appropriation.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And the difference with the amounts that are contained in HB 3003 that were appropriated by the House for the dividend fund, the funds that the House was looking to appropriate from the statutory budget reserve fund were funds that remained after the SB or the FY22 appropriations in HB 69 were accounted for. And so they were only looking to appropriate the balance, so to speak, of the SBR. And so while the House has appropriated those funds in HB 3003, the position from the administration is that those funds are not available because they've been swept into the CBR.
And the advice that you provided to the House and at least to House Finance was that the funds were not subject to sweep, hence they were available for appropriation at the time we approved Senate House Bill 3003.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Our advice to the committee is that it seemed that the funds were likely available based on the AFN versus Dunleavy litigation and decision based on the analysis that we've already gone over in this hearing, but with the caution that was a Superior Court decision and that there was some risk of using those funds because it wasn't finding precedent on future courts.
All right, other questions for members of the committee? All right, last chance. Representative Drummond, you've been quiet. Do you have any questions for either Ms. Mills or Ms. Wallace?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And Representative Snyder, you also have been quiet. Any questions for either Ms. Wallace or Ms. Mills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I've been listening intently. Wanted to thank you for that helpful discussion. Particularly these last 5 or 10 minutes have been enlightening. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm not hearing any other questions from the committee, and so we are going to wind up our hearing. We will hold the joint resolution for further review, and we're going to adjourn for the day. And so the time is now looks like 2:22 p.m., so we are adjourned.